Okay, welcome all. Reminder, we are recording this session. The audio file will be posted on the Q&A section of the website along with a PDF of the deck that gets presented this evening, as well as the chat window contents will all go up there, courtesy of Alan's hard work. And again, if you have any question as we go through things, by all means, you could drop it into the chat. We'll cover off things on there. If you wanted to join into the active discussion point, by all means, unmute yourself if you want, and you can participate that way. And with that, I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, so you should be seeing my title slide.
We are.
Good. Okay, so starting off, we have a follow-up item. He said, hopefully. There we go. Copying image files, and this is courtesy of Chris.
Was that what courtesy of me? Okay. I thought we had covered this last week, but I guess maybe not. So Robocopy is a program that is included with all versions of Windows since Vista. It did originally come out with the NT Resource Kit, and you had to install it separately, but it's in the System32 directory now on all versions of Windows, so you can happily take advantage of it. One of the neat things it has is a slash L switch, which I guess is for listing. And what it does is it gives you an idea about what Robocopy will do without actually doing anything. So because you've got so many switches that are available in the program that can do weird and wonderful things, it's kind of nice to be able to run it in a test mode where you can see what would have happened. And when you refine all your switches and get them all right, then you just have to remove the slash L switch and it'll actually do its thing. So that's kind of nice. Okay, next there, Alan.
You talk about the summary and the default.
Oh, okay. It does give you an on-screen thing. You can redirect it to a file if you want. And the summary is kind of nice. It tells you how many files got copied, how many got deleted, how many bytes were copied, how many were skipped because the file already existed and you had a switch that said not to overwrite existing files or things like that. So it's a nice summary at the bottom which tells you overall what has happened. But you'll see line by line every file what is done. And then by default, it will skip files that exist in the destination. It only looks at the name, size, and date stamps, so it doesn't actually look at the contents of the file to see whether the file you're trying to copy over is different than the one that exists in the destination. But in most cases, if you are copying a file from one place to another and the file exists in the other place with the same name, size, and date, then in all likelihood it is identical file. But just keep in mind that it doesn't do the actual check on the content of the file. You can log things to a file. You could either do it through a redirection symbol, or you can do slash log colon and then put in a path and a file name. As Alan found out when he was doing some testing, make sure that you have the ability to write to that log location. Otherwise, things will fail with an error. There are a lot of switches that are available that allow you to modify how it does its copying, what gets copied, what gets skipped. You can do things like exclude files that are larger than a certain file size or smaller than a certain file size or something that is older than 5 days old or has only been, you know, it's been modified in the last 2 days or not accessed in the last number of days, things like that. And then one of the really nifty things is if you just run it in a command window, you can actually run it with slash mon colon and x, where x is the number of minutes, and it will actually look at the source directory looking for changes according to your switches every few minutes, whatever you put in as the x, and it'll do whatever that command was. So it's a nice way that you can have an automatic backup of files. As new files pop up in the source directory, it'll automatically copy them over to the destination directory if that's what the aim was and the switches you used amount to. So here was an example of when Alan threw out the challenge to, you know, copying files that are graphics or picture files, and he had a few stipulations that he wanted on what it would do. So with RoboCopy, you just have RoboCopy and then the source directory, the destination directory, and then you can have multiple file types, so you can string together as many as you want. So in this case, it's star.jpg space star.gif to be able to copy those two file types. Slash s tells it to go through all of the subdirectories below the source directory, and then it's going to log it to a file, /logs/, and then the file name will be robo-jpeg-gif.txt, and the slash l. So the slash l tells it to just tell me what it's going to do, but don't actually do anything. When you're satisfied that it's actually going to do what you want, all you have to do is hit the up arrow key once. It'll bring back your last command at the command line. Backspace twice to remove the slash l. Hit enter, and it'll actually do its thing.
Okay. So I was actually interested in this command too. So as Chris said, I did a little experiment with it. The reason it failed was because I told it that the target drive for my log file was going to be drive C. And on my system, at any rate, anywhere I try and write onto drive C, I need administrative permission. And typically I run Windows as a regular user. So RoboCopy failed, but it gave me an error message and told me that file, the location wasn't available. So I basically just had it write to my data partition instead. So I've used essentially the same string, but there's also another file, another switch, which is actually quite useful. So I can put in a slash NFL. It's either National Football League or no file list or something like that. But basically, instead of listing every file as the actual command would, every JPEG, every GIF file, if I say NFL, then it doesn't list the actual files, but it will list the folders in which they're contained in. So by logging the output, I can actually get a list of the folders where all my image files reside. So this is kind of an example of the resulting text file. And you can see I basically got some summary information, and then there's a whole raft of folders where the various images are found. So if we were interested in trying to find where all the, if we had images all over the disk, we wanted to consolidate them into, say, a single photograph folder or something, then we could identify where they are using this thing and then judiciously copy them to the folder of choice. But that's still a bit of a handful, so I'd actually like to tidy that list up a bit. And the way I would do it is to pull it into a spreadsheet. And you'll notice that in the text file here, the rows, the columns right here, are basically set up with tabs. So if I try and import this into a spreadsheet, it's essentially like a comma-delimited file, but instead of being delimited by commas, it's delimited by tabs. So I tell it I want the separator option to be the tab character. And it shows me down here what it's going to look like. And basically, it looks like this. So it's essentially pulled out different columns, and I can tidy that up quite quickly. And I'm not interested in column A and column B. They're no use to me, so I can delete those. And then if I sort column C, it will get rid of all these blank spaces and all anything else that's not a folder that interests me. And I'll end up with a list, which is like this. And now I can quickly go through that, and I can find things like recycle bin, which I'm not interested in that as a folder to keep. And then I've got an archives folder, which has some images somewhere. And then I've got subfolders. So I could get rid of those subfolders and just worry about the archives. And the same thing with my Alan and Carol home page. There's a bunch of different folders inside that one major folder. So by playing around with this spreadsheet, I could quite quickly and come up with a list of main folders where all my images are located. So that's the way I would do it. But then I thought, well, you know, we have this members forum. And if you're a PCUG, an OPCUG member, and you're not a member, or not subscribed to the members forum, all you have to do is send an email to this address, and we can sign you up. And then you can ask questions. So it's like having a Q&A session on a 24/7 basis. So I put the question to the group, and I said, what's the most efficient way to find all of the folders that contain image files and list just the folder names? So I want the folders, but I don't want the names of the individual files. And then I said, you know, JPEGs are fine, but if you can tell me how to do JPEGs and GIFs and PNGs and all kinds of other things, that would be better. And within a few minutes, I had the replies. And the first one I got was from Chris. And he suggested a very simple way of doing it using the DIR command. So he says, use the DIR star.jpg and then use the /s, which is a recursive look through all the folders thing. And when you do that, and you could actually redirect that to a file, you'll get this list of folders and image files. But I said, I don't want these image names. I just want the things that are highlighted in red, the actual folder names. So he said, no problem. You take the DIR command, you run it into a find filter, and you look for directory of, and then you redirect that to text file. So basically, you're just going to get a list a bit like this thing right here, where you've just got directory of and then a subfolder, directory of and then another subfolder. And if I want to get different images, then I have to use a for command. And you remember we've talked about that before. For the extension in a list of extensions, do, and then the DIR command. And then following up on that, he tells me that if I run a PowerShell script, I could actually get rid of these directories of, and here's a little script that basically replaces directory of with nothing and then sends it to a file that says that directory of has been stripped. And then,
before anybody says that, Chris, can you write a PowerShell script for me? No, I can't. I just Googled on a couple of terms, and I found somebody else had written a PowerShell script, and I just I modified it very, very slightly. But, yeah, I don't know PowerShell, and so I just scavenge what I can find on the Internet, and there's tons of examples out there.
That's right, but it turns out it's interesting what you find when you use different search terms, because I didn't find that PowerShell script when I was searching for, you know, how do you find and copy image files. And Andrew Petrovich gave me another link to a super user forum where they also have a PowerShell essentially script. And you can see basically they define an extension type, star.jpg, and then they use a PowerShell command where they do a directory of drive C using that file name type. They recurse it, so you get all the folders, and then select directory unique, I think, kind of gets rid of that directory name. Then he sorts on the directories and exports as a CSV, a comma-separated file, to A, and this one is going to drive C, so in my case it wouldn't work, but clearly I could modify that, and we send it to a file called alljpegs.csv. So define the file type and then use this command to create a CSV file, and then I can pull that CSV file into the spreadsheet, and now PowerShell has actually done the magic in terms of removing the file names and only listing the directories and and the sorting them and all that kind of good stuff. So basically it cuts out that those commands that I had to use in the spreadsheet to develop that basic list. So there's a whole raft of ways to do it. Clearly, if you ask the right questions, you get the right answer. So thanks to everybody who participated in that. And then we had a follow-up question. User says, PowerShell is more powerful than command.exe, the command line, but the PowerShell command is often different than that used in essentially a DOS command prompt. So do we have to learn a whole new set of commands and command syntax? And I guess the answer is yes and no. Some of the commands are the same, as the example here, just a dir gives you essentially a directory listing, but with some new parameters. So you can see file attributes there and so on. but as we saw in the examples, there are a lot of different commands that exist in PowerShell that don't exist in the command prompt. But as Chris says, if you Google, you'll probably find a PowerShell script or a command that will do what you want. I don't know if anybody has any other comments on PowerShell. I personally haven't used it myself, so I'm not that familiar with it.
Nothing in the chat.
Okay, moving right along then. Here's a follow-up on VPNs. This is one for Chris.
Yeah, I threw this one in because a number of Q&A sessions ago, we talked about VPNs and how they actually work and what they do and what they don't do. And one of the cautions I'd thrown out there was that you really have to trust your VPN provider, because you're doing an encrypted tunnel to the VPN provider, and then your traffic is going out to the internet from there. Any of the traffic coming back is going to the VPN provider and then back to your computer over that encrypted tunnel. And so a lot of people will use it to disguise where they're actually coming from, whether it's for whatever purposes. One is any services that block you by geolocation, you can get around it by going through a VPN tunnel. But if you're doing anything that is really nefarious or shady, and you think that nobody can see what you're doing, well, the VPN server can show what you're doing. A lot of them say that they don't keep any logs, or they keep logs for a very short period of time. And I happened across this article on just the 20th, 2 days ago, on Naked Security blog at Sophos, 7 VPNs that leaked their logs, and these were logs that supposedly didn't exist. And these were 7 VPN providers. They were in Hong Kong, I believe it was. And a bunch of log files showed up somewhere from these 7 VPN providers. And the information that was in the logs were pretty shocking. A lot of personal identifiable information, names, emails, home addresses, clear text passwords, Bitcoin payment information, support messages, personal device information, tech specs, account info, direct PayPal API links. Pretty scary that the VPN provider could actually have access to that information, and they did log it, and they didn't secure the logs. So if you are using a VPN, make sure that to the extent that you can, you trust your VPN provider. I don't have anything more than that to share on this particular one. Just a caution that some people probably wish they hadn't been using a VPN provider.
Okay, our next item is a follow-up on running programs as an administrator. And I usually, let's talk about the command prompt, for example. I usually search for that by entering CMD in the search window down the bottom of the taskbar. And then once I've done that, I can right-click on command prompt. And then once I do that, I get a context menu where I can select run as administrator. So that's the way I would normally run a program as an administrator. But I think Chris has a number of other options of this sleeve?
Yeah, basically anywhere that you can actually run a program from, whether it's in the start menu or actually let me share my screen. So I'm going to take over here and I'm going to share my screen. So if I click on the start menu, I hope this isn't too tiny for everybody. I got a pretty high res screen. If you click on the start menu, you have all your programs listed in the list there. I can right click on any one of those. Well, not that one, I can't. some seems that doesn't allow you to do that. I can right click on this one here. I can go to more and run as administrator. If I have a desktop icon, so let me just minimize some stuff here. Oops, sorry. Let's close that. I will. Well, I don't know what's going on here, but if I have a shortcut on the desktop, like Zoom, I can right-click on it and choose run as administrator. If I'm in the file system and I go find a program somewhere, so let's go to... So I'm in System 32, which is a rich source of all kinds of programs. So a DLL is actually a program, but let's actually go down to find an EXE somewhere. Looks like I'm only finding DLLs. Okay, I should be able to do it on here if I right-click on it. Maybe I can't run as an administrator for a DLL, but let's go to, there's got to be EXEs in here.
You could search for star.exe.
Yeah, I've got, things are sorted here by, oh, it's reverse sorted, okay. So DLL. By now I would have actually gotten, there we go, EXEs. So if I right-click on an executable program on there, then I have the option run as administrator. So basically the lesson on here is that anywhere that you can normally run a program from, don't start the program, but you can right-click on that thing that will start the program, and you'll get a pop-up menu, and run as administrator will be one of them. So I'll turn that back over to Alan.
Okay, so moving on, Chris has a thought about the May 2020 update of Windows and a new setting.
Yeah, this is kind of cool. I just stumbled across this as I was troubleshooting a problem that I had with my network. And I hadn't seen it before, and I still have one computer that hasn't been updated to 2020 May update. And so I verified that indeed this seems to be brand new with the 2020 update. So let me actually see if I can... get to it. So settings. I'm just gonna see if I can find it here before I.
We've yeah. Got a couple okay. Slides coming up, Chris, with the thing on.
What's that?
You have a couple of slides that you sent me with the settings.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. Go ahead then. Yeah. There we go. So this is the way it looks. So if you go to settings, network and internet, and on the status, which is the first screen that will come up. You'll actually see at the near the top, it'll show you your network name. In my case, I just named it Ethernet. And it shows me that I've used 90.5 gigabytes in the last 30 days. And if I click on data usage.
And just before we do that, just notice down here, there's also a properties button that we'll come back to in a second.
Okay.
But for now, you're going to hit the data usage button.
And it'll actually give you by program on your computer, which is really cool. So I can see that Chrome used the vast majority, which my web browser doesn't really surprise me. System is probably updates to Windows that use 11.92 gigabytes was probably the update to the spring 2020 update. And then I can see various apps. So if you're finding that you're running into data caps or anything like that, you could go into here and see, well, what the heck is using all my bandwidth? And if you want, you could stop using those or whatever. But it'll help you track things down. And you also have, you notice there's an enter limit on the data limit. So if you are capped on your data and you pay overcharges, you can actually put in a limit on there, and then it'll let you know when you're getting close to it. Notice that they say this won't change your data plan. So it's not like entering a limit will actually allow you to download more or anything like that.
Okay, so the follow-up question on that was about this data usage properties button. If you hit that, apparently it goes into a wireless setting and then gives you an option for random hardware addresses. And you can enable that on a by network option. It's supposed to make it difficult to track the device. And the question is this a new feature? And is it any good? Anybody have any thoughts on, I've never used this, so I don't know. Anybody have any thoughts? I see Lawrence shaking his head. I guess if that data usage is a new feature in the update, then the properties must be too, right?
I'm not sure on that, whether like properties of your wireless adapter has always been there. So I mean that goes back many versions of Windows, where you could actually get into the properties of any network adapter. The idea of being able to easily do a random hardware address, I think, is relatively new, but I don't know if it goes back to any previous version of Windows 10. If anybody else has an idea on that, by all means, pop in. In terms of its utility, I don't know. I mean, every network adapter has a hardware address. It's the MAC address, media access control address of the device, and it should be unique worldwide. And so, yes, in theory, the idea is that your computer can be uniquely identified worldwide. And the MAC address is included in the TCP/IP traffic that is going around. So, yeah, it can track you, but the very fact that you can actually change what is the MAC address on your computer, I sort of think, like, is it meaningless now? And, I mean, Linux has allowed you to go into the network config file and specify a MAC address, any MAC address you want, since I think Linux began. So this is nothing really new. And personally, I don't think that it's going to buy anybody anything. But hey, if somebody else has got an idea, by all means, pipe in, because I really haven't done any research on it or anything like that. Anybody feel like unmuting themselves and giving an opinion? I don't see anything in the chat. So personally, I wouldn't bother.
Just a little question. If there is a conflict between two MAC addresses, would that be a problem?
Good point, because it is supposed to be unique worldwide. I don't know. Certainly you can get into problems if on your own network, if you have multiple devices that have the same MAC address, you definitely can have problems. But once you're out on the internet, I'm really not sure whether the MAC address is used for any purposes of like routing or anything like that. I think it falls back at that point to the IP address being unique as opposed to the MAC address being unique. But I have heard people having problems on local area networks that had MAC addresses the same. But that might even be gone away too. I don't know. This was years ago that I heard this, and it might have been back from the days when TCP/IP on a Windows PC was a relatively new thing, and they might have been communicating and keeping track of devices by MAC address as opposed to an IP address. I don't know.
Okay. And so another question that came in related to TeamViewer, and the member is using it for personal use, but TeamViewer was sending him an email saying they had detected commercial use and he had to register. Pricing for the pay-for version of TeamViewer starts at $58 per month for a single user. And he was getting multiple emails. So his question is there another program that's comparable to TeamViewer and that's either free for personal use or really cheap, like $1 a month? Personally, I've used TeamViewer for quite a while, and I've never had any problems, and it's worked very well. And so I've never looked for anything else. I know TeamViewer is remote control software, and Chris has mentioned previously the Windows version, which I forget what it's called right now.
Quick Assist,
right, which is built into Windows, so that's certainly an option. Is it as good as TeamViewer?
Well, one of the things that TeamViewer gives you that is not in Quick Assist is the ability to set up your computer to allow a remote connection to it even if you're not at your computer. So Quick Assist assumes that you are going to be at your computer, you're asking somebody else for help, and you allow them to connect, and you will get a prompt on screen saying so-and-so is trying to connect to your computer, do you want to allow it or not? If you're not there to answer that prompt, nobody's going to be able to connect to your computer. Now, that can be a good thing or a bad thing. I have TeamViewer set up on my computer, and I'm logged into the TeamViewer server all the time. If I go to another computer anywhere in the world, I can go load up the TeamViewer and then log in. It will show me that, oh, your home computer there is available for connection, and I can double-click on it, and even though nobody's at the home computer to acknowledge it, I can actually connect to, and it's as if I'm sitting in front of the keyboard. So that's something that's really, really nice about TeamViewer that a lot of the other free services, such as VNC is another one. Actually, VNC, I think you can actually set up to allow a remote connection without prompting, but Quick Assist is assuming somebody's there to answer that prompt. I suspect that what happened with this person was that TeamViewer, every now and then they will say, are you using this for personal use or for commercial? And as long as you keep saying that it's for personal use, you're fine. But if you click once saying that, oh, you're using it in a business or whatever, or saying it's not personal use, then I think you'll get this where they'll flag it and they'll say, oh, okay, you have to pay for it then. And you can't turn around easily and say, oh, I clicked on the wrong button. I really am personal use. As this person found out, he's been in communication with TeamViewer and he has to jump through hoops to try to get his account set back so that it is personal use. And I don't think he's quite there yet.
I think he is. I think there's a message today saying that he finally got a reply saying that they'd reset his account.
Okay.
The reply came in German, but apparently Google Translate does a real good job with German, so he was able to translate it.
Good stuff. But a cautionary note, I guess, anybody using TeamViewer, when you watch for those prompts that ask you if you're using it in a commercial environment or it's personal use, make sure you always click on personal.
So anybody else have any thoughts on remote control software?
Just before we go on, Lawrence did have something that he posted into the group chat about random hardware addressing. And when you're not connected to Wi-Fi, your PC sends a signal to look for Wi-Fi networks in the area, get connected. Oh, and it uses the MAC address at that point in time. So... yeah. So there are cases where MAC addresses still could be considered to be unique. And if you are not unique, then I guess there still are problems. So Lawrence posted a Microsoft support article in the chat window. So if you're interested in that, check out the chat. It'll also be available on our Q&A website after probably tomorrow sometime. Thanks, Lawrence.
Okay, so the next question is almost a follow-up to Chris's note that it's good to have a second administrative account. One of our members was using WordPerfect X5, which every time he tried to open or create a new document in landscape mode, WordPerfect would crash and close down. But when he set up this secondary administrator's account and used that, WordPerfect runs fine. So the question is, why? Anybody have any answer to that question? I never used WordPerfect, so I don't know.
I think Chris nailed it previously with the template comment.
Yeah, in all likelihood, I think it's a template. You can have in WordPerfect, you can have, because it was only crashed when creating a new document, and it was a landscape mode document, all WordPerfect documents, when you create a new one, they are all based on a template. So if you are creating a new document and you want it landscape mode, it will pick a particular template file. And if it's crashing because of, you know, at that point in time, I would be willing to bet that that template was corrupted. There is a possibility, not really likely in this particular case, but because different profiles have different registries for the user hive, there is, I guess, a possibility that there could be something in the registry that would actually be causing it. But this one, because I know WordPerfect does base every new document on a template, that I suspect that's the case. The trick would be to track down which template it was. Delete the template. WordPerfect will recreate any needed templates automatically when you restart. So if this is one of the stock required templates, it would be automatically recreated. If not, you could create a new document and then set it up in the landscape mode, all the settings you want, and then save it as a template, and then you'd be able to use it later on as a template. So that's my thoughts on it. If anybody else has any other ideas, though, by all means, like to hear any other ideas for what might cause this.
Word can do the same thing. And in fact, I got one user that somehow has got Word in this loop, Word and Excel both, in which it refuses to save what she's typing, but it's very random. And anyways, she's had some very colorful words to say to her computer after it does it randomly. And to this day, I'm not sure, but I believe it has something to do with her normal .dot that keeps on getting recreated from her account. It's very strange. It's the only time I've seen it.
Yeah.
So it just underlines the template can be the root of all evil type of thing.
Yeah. Joss just posted into the chat window, there's a program that lets you see what files are being accessed. And yes, there is a, used to be FileMon, one of the sysinternal tools. Mark Rasinovich, who's a Microsoft fellow, he's now VP in charge of Azure, and he wrote a bunch of utilities for originally back in the NT days, and he's been keeping them up to date. And so there used to be one called FileMon. I think it's been rolled in with FileMon and SysMon into a single tool. I can't remember what the tool name is. But it will allow you to track in real time all the files that are being accessed in the file system. And so if you can tune it down so it is only showing the stuff that you're really interested in, otherwise you have hundreds of accesses a second often. But if you can track it down to that, you could find exactly what file it is that's being accessed at the point you crash. If anybody's really interested in that, let me know and I can track down what the tool is, but bear in mind that it's not for the faint of heart to use. It's a very, very powerful tool, and as such, it is tricky to use effectively as well.
Okay, next question is dealing with Skype. And the question is, Skype's running on a PC, but the user wants to run it on an iPad or a tablet. And how do they synchronize the contacts from the PC to the tablet? Is it possible with minimal effort, and what steps are required? Any Skype users out there that know the answer?
Well, I don't know if I only use Skype when I have to, but this question confused me because that's the one thing I've never had an issue with, is that whenever I've logged in to Skype from whatever client I was using, all my contacts that I used in Skype from over a decade would pop up automatically.
So that suggests that Skype is maintaining that list on its server, not on your device.
So I don't know if this is one of those things where I've been living in ignorance for over a decade or what. So I'll be curious to hear if anyone else has any comments.
Guess you're the Skype user, Lawrence.
Oh, wow. That's troubling. Anyways, that's all. I'll stand by that. I don't know what else to say. I did not think that it was the two would separate.
I tended to think along the same lines, but I haven't used Skype in probably 10 years. And one thing I'll say about Skype is that it's a real moving target. Microsoft changes it. It seems like almost on a weekly basis. So how it acts one day could be considerably different from the way it acts another day.
Also, there's the issue that Microsoft decided in their wisdom that everybody should switch over to a Microsoft account. And I remember doing that. And I thought, okay, fine, I get it. This is what Microsoft's doing. And then it turns out that Microsoft backtracked. And so my old Skype account that's over a decade old is still there, running perfectly, no problem. And I thought I went through the steps of saying, yes, bring this account over to my Microsoft account because you told me to. But I now have two accounts, and I don't use the Microsoft account to get into Skype now.
I was really bothered, actually, when Microsoft was making those overtures to changing over to a Microsoft account. I actually have a Skype account, C. Taylor, which to get such a short, sweet, account name was really, really nice. But it turns out I just don't use Skype anyway, so I don't really care. Any other things on Skype? If not, I'll mention one thing going backwards in our deck. So Josh just posted FileMon and RegMon. So FileMon was monitored file accesses. RegMon monitored accesses to the registry. They're no longer available for download as separate entities. They've been rolled into Process Monitor, which is one app that will do that plus an awful lot of extra things. So if you are looking to get into the nitty-gritty of what's going on in Windows, Process Monitor is the tool that will get you there for sure.
Okay, so here's a very general question. We're collecting lots of digital stuff, photographs and music, and scanning paper documents, the PDFs or whatever. What are the best practices in determining what to keep in archives and what to delete? Any archivists in the crowd tonight?
I do have a solution. I'm not sure if it's an elegant solution, but it works. And that is storage is cheap. You copy it on two separate devices. You put them in the filing cabinet or lock them away in your safety deposit box, whatever, and forget about it.
I tend to agree.
And every 5 years, buy another hard drive because it's the same price as it was before, but now it's four times the capacity. I guess the one thing I'd say is that it's probably a good idea to archive the program that reads all this stuff. Because that's one of the problems, is having the right hardware and software.
Proprietary file for sure.
Yeah, and just keeping the program around might not be enough either, because you might end up with the program can't run on whatever your current operating system is. And so, yeah, digital file formats can be a really, really big pain in the butt. I know Library and Archives Canada, a couple of years ago, I talked a bunch with them, and they had real issues with that. And they were really at the point of they thought the best thing to do was to print everything and keep the paper, because it actually didn't. They knew how to look after paper. They didn't know how to look after a WordPerfect 1.0 file format and things like that.
Those medieval scribes had the right idea. That's what you're telling me. Okay.
I think
right. So. I'm following up on that. How do you get your executor or your trustee to manage your online accounts and maintain your digital legacy, and what do you do with all the hardware?
Okay.
Nope.
I can.
You wanna take it?
I'll start. I mean, it's an imperfect world. As I mentioned in my password phrasing, and it's not. So this is not legal advice, okay? Let's be clear on this. But the fact of the matter is that if you get incapacitated, you don't have to die, you can be incapacitated for whatever reason. I feel it's very important for someone to be able to access your accounts on your behalf. Obviously, you're going to have to trust that individual. So if you're using a password booklet that you write down on pen and paper, and you have it in a locked door, make sure someone else has that key or can access that key to get that book out if they have to. If you're using a password manager, make sure that, and a lot of the password managers do have this functionality of providing a file that allows a person that you trust to gain access to your account. If your account isn't accessed, then I think it was 10 days, and I was looking for it for, we're using Keeper Security right now, and I was pretty sure that there's a thing, and I think I took advantage of it and sent it to my son, but I couldn't find it this evening. So I'm guessing other password managers have a similar thing. The reason I'm saying all that is that if you try to follow the rules, well, good luck. I mean, you know, just even Facebook, for example. And you can't blame them, but at the same time, they do not make it easy for you to take over in someone else's account legally.
Hi, it's Corrine. I actually put this question up because I'm an executor for a friend of mine who passed away. And it's a nightmare if you don't record things down. And, you know, whether you have a Google account, Gmail, you have Facebook, you have LinkedIn, best practice would be for you to put pen and paper, or put it somewhere on a file on your computer that's accessible. But I guess there are some issues if you have to go and ask Facebook for the account. I've heard of that in the past, but I just thought maybe in the future for this group, it would be maybe worth it to bring somebody in that has a legal background to advise us on, you know, how to, you know, what to put in our own wills or whatever to say, you know, here's how to manage my digital life. I'm just throwing it out there. I don't have a solution.
It's Alan did pass along, and you bring up a very interesting topic. And yes, I've noted it down that I should see if I could find someone that would be able to provide some guidance. I hope it's something that they're able to do without interfering with any legal requirements that they may have.
Yeah, it's interesting to really look at it from a legal point of view, I suppose, but I think it becomes more fundamental than having to worry about the lawyers. So I've been putting together a presentation on how to use KeePass, which is a free open source password manager. And so I have a couple of slides on digital inheritance. So first off is you really don't want to let your online accounts die with you. And so you want to have it that others can get access to your online accounts, or you have to decide if you want other people to be able to get access to your online accounts or not. It may be impossible. Like if you go to Facebook, forget it. They're not going to give you access without a court order, and you're highly unlikely to be able to get a court order. No matter if you can do it, it's always going to be difficult to do it. And it may be costly if you have to get lawyers involved in order to get access to some of these online services and things like that. So if you do use a password manager like KeePass, which doesn't have an online presence, so you can't go to the vendor and say that, like Lawrence had, where if it hasn't been used in 10 days, you know, somebody else will be able to access it or something like that. Nobody else has a way with KeePass to know whether you're accessing it or not. So you can provide access yourself. And so you can decide, okay, I will give the password to my KeePass database, which is on my computer, and so they'll need access to the computer as well. But all the information can be in your KeePass database on how to access all your accounts. As a minimum, what you would want to let them know is that you do have a KeePass database. You don't have to teach them how to use it or anything like that. If they need access to it, they can take the time then to learn how to use it properly. Tell them the name and location of your database file, which is a KBDX file, and let them know the password to open the password database. A little bit better would be give person links to help information on how to use KeePass, or show them how it works so that they don't stumbling around accidentally deleting entries or something like that. Give them details about what you want done with online accounts. You know, I want my Facebook account closed. I want my bank account this. I want my email to do this, you know, send an email to everybody that's in my contacts, telling them that no more email from me, whatever. Consider a KeePass entry such as !README so that it sorts at the top, and that'll detail exactly what you want the person who is going to take over your KeePass database and access to all your accounts to do. I would say leave information with, and this is somewhat in order of, I think, preference, power of attorney, I think, is probably the best choice. The reason is, if you've given somebody power of attorney, you have basically given them the right to take all your money away from you. You know, so they can act on your behalf for monetary things. And so if you've trusted somebody with all the money you own in the world, then maybe you can leave them with the power to access your online accounts as well. Executor is not bad, except an executor, their duties only kick in after you die, so it doesn't deal with if you're in a coma or something like that, where you still want your bills to be paid, you still want, you know, emails to be answered or whatever. Just somebody else that you trust an awful lot. Keep in mind, if you decide you no longer trust them, you better change the password on your KeePass database. You could put it in a safety deposit box, which would be pretty secure that nobody's going to accidentally or nefariously get access to it. The trouble is, who's going to be able to access it? In the event of death, you're probably going to have somebody who's going to stumble across the idea that you have a safety deposit box and be able to access it. It might not be so easy if you're just in a coma. The other thing that I think is really important to think of is if you're the executor or power of attorney for somebody else. And so it's probably a good idea to sit down and talk with that person about what they want done with their online accounts. If they're using Password Keeper Manager, do they want to give you access to that? Do they want to just give you access to, you know, give you the accounts and the passwords individually? Whatever it is. But talk to the people in advance so that you're not on the condition where they are incapacitated or dead, that you're stumbling around trying to figure out what needs to be done. So those are just some thoughts that I had on digital inheritance. I think it probably is a really good idea if you think about it in advance rather than worrying about it afterwards.
Yeah, that's a great, those are all great points. Chris, thank you very much. It's Corinne again.
Yep.
I think in the legal community, I believe that if you're going to have your will prepared by a lawyer instead of a kit, I don't know nowadays if they give advice on how to manage your digital life. And so that's all I was asking for is it may be worthwhile to find out and have somebody talk to us, or if we could go through the library too, Chris, you know, the Ottawa Library, because this is something that lots of people should know how to do. Your points are very well taken, and I'm going to look at them again to prepare myself. But it's also going back to what your archives are kind of associated, because if you are the keeper of the family photos, and they're all digitized, or you digitize them and you thrown away the black and whites or whatever, or you're the keeper of all the digital photos, and you know, when people are looking to prepare something, a memorial service, then they're going to be hooped in that they can't get access to any of them. So I'm just saying this out loud, not that it's happening to me, because I still like to look through photo albums. And not digital. So, I mean, I'm just saying this because it's very real, and I'm facing this dilemma myself. So, it's not pleasant.
No, I agree, and that's why it's really good to think about this in advance. So, asking the questions is really important, and thinking about what you want done with your stuff, before you can no longer voice an opinion on it.
Yeah, exactly.
Very important.
Exactly. And it's true. It's very different when you have a power of attorney for if you're incapacitated, or during those times where, you know, if you're going to have surgery and maybe you just can't get, you don't have access to your computer or something. I mean, you don't have to be in a coma. It doesn't have to be that critical. So,
yep.
I mean, but it's really just keeping ourselves organized. Lots of people don't want to face it, but I think it's the adult thing to do.
Yep.
The other aspect of that question was what should happen to the hardware. And a couple of sessions ago, we talked about securely erasing hard drives and taking the SIM card out of smartphones and that kind of thing. So you also have to be concerned about the security of devices where personal information is stored in the device somewhere.
Joss posted something, a Facebook link that says the question, what will happen to my Facebook account if I pass away? And you can choose to either appoint a legacy contact to look after your memorialized account or have your account permanently deleted. The point there, again, is the fact that you have to decide that up front. And so if you have appoint a legacy contact, personally, I think you have so many more things than just Facebook to look after, to just give them access to your Facebook account and let them know what you want done with it. If you're unable to look after yourself, then I think that's as good as going through Facebook and saying, oh, okay, I have a legacy contact.
Yeah, the nice thing about Facebook is that you can, there is a web page, and I provided a link there, is that you can let somebody else and say, yes, you are now passed away, and they will memorialize the Facebook so that the content does not disappear, but you cannot change it anymore. That's a nice way to sort of let people know that, well, your new status.
I think if anybody looked at my Facebook account, they would think that I died about 5 years ago.
Okay. Question about a router, an intermittent buzz on a D-Link DIR 859, 4 years old, end of service coming up in August. The support line suggests changing the location of the power connection and upgrading the firmware. Rebooting it helps for short periods of time. Any suggestions, anybody? Anybody have any buzzing routers?
I have a bit of an opinion on this. It's just a very generic thing. If you ever have computer equipment that wasn't making noise and starts making noise, or was always making noises and stopped making noises, you're in a problem situation. So this particular circumstance, I don't know, but I would say it falls into the category, one of those categories, where something that was normally silent is suddenly making noise, probably is not a good thing. I would plan for replacement of the device.
And let's face it, we're talking about a router that protects your entire network. Replacing it every 4 years, not a bad thing to do.
Yeah, you get better security typically, better speeds, more capabilities.
I have a suggestion. Do people put these things on some kind of electrical outlet that's got that prevents brownouts? And do you have that at your house? Do people have that at their panel where it can smooth the power out at certain times of the day? Or do you plug it into a power bar? You know, those kind of things. That could be part of it too, because I know over time, like electrical circuits degrade. So having just done some major work at my dead friend's condo about power with the electricity, there is always that issue. There could be that issue, especially when the demand for electricity, it depends on the time of the day. I'm just throwing that out there because that could be something to consider.
You have power issues? Yes. A battery power UPS is a godsend. Yeah. I have three of them. Three? Probably, maybe four.
It's a pretty expensive solution unless you really need it, though.
I agree. One of them is a carryover from when I was trying to run a business. But irregardless, it protects the entertainment equipment and my network main incoming router, and it gives me 20 minutes of internet connection whenever the power goes out. So I consider it worthwhile.
And one thing to keep in mind with a UPS is that the batteries don't last forever.
And
they typically are quite expensive to replace the batteries. So if you're on a cheaper UPS, it might be cheaper just to replace it. And again, you're probably looking at, I don't know, what would you say, Lawrence, like every 4 or 5 years?
Yes, 4 or 5 years for a battery. And to get something with some a reasonable protection, $100.
Oh, that's not bad.
I mean, you can easily spend a couple of $100, but I tend to go with smaller units, and that way I can spread them out.
Bob Walker's on the call. I know that you, Bob, you use a UPS, don't you?
Yeah, I keep my router, my internet modem, my VoIP phone box, and a few things plugged into a UPS that'll give me about an hour's backup in the event of a power failure. And I live out in the country, and power outages and little power winkies and everything are very common. I recently added a UPS to my home entertainment system, my TV and PVR. Because one of those little power winkies where the power goes out for a bit of a second, crashed the PR, and I lost 200 hours worth of programming. So,
wow.
I really believe in UPSs, and with the 1 hour window there, I can keep things going. And if it looks like the power failure is going to be any longer, I wheel out the generator and hook everything up.
And I suggest also that if there's anything on the same AC line that has a motor to it, for example, a blender, a sewing machine, a washing machine, or else, that might cause some noise on the AC line that could be giving your router some issues too.
UPS used to be pretty big and heavy, but now with the new batteries, lithium batteries and so on, are they now much smaller and last a lot longer?
Yes. Yeah, you wouldn't get an hour. I mean, Bob, how big is your UPS to give you an hour?
I forget the specs off the top of my head, but it's physically a fair size.
Yeah, how heavy do you feel it is?
Oh, I'd hesitate to guess. It's been a long time since I actually picked the thing up. It's just been sitting there doing its job.
And I know that...
half a dozen times.
Yeah, I know that the ones I have at the office, I have a colleague of mine who works out regularly, and I just call him Mr. Muscle, and I get him to come over, and he hefts them with no problems.
Well, as a point of comparison, it's the same model UPS on my home entertainment system as I use for all the other stuff. And none of the other stuff takes a lot of current, so it'll last for an hour. The one hooked up to my TV, it's there basically to guard against power winkies, and if the power goes out, I've got maybe 5 minutes before the big screen TV and the PVR and everything else wear the batteries down. So the how long they last depends quite a bit on the load.
I know that car starter, now they can be the size of almost of a cigarette pack. So the technology has improved a lot. So I was wondering about that.
They come in all sizes.
Yeah.
Okay, we've kind of 5-7 minutes over, but I think we're coming up to the last prepared question. Somebody updated to the latest version of ESUS to do backup. Do they need to create a new bootable drive? And with both a desktop and a laptop, do you need a bootable stick for each machine? And Chris knows the answer to this one.
Yeah, I've used ESUS for quite a few years. It's usually not necessary. The file format for the backup file hasn't changed in many, many years. So older versions of ESUS to do backup can read the backup files no problem at all. But because the idea behind new versions of the program is that they are fixing bugs and there could be compatibility issues, things like that, it's not a bad idea to update it to the newest version. It doesn't cost you anything to do that, so you may as well do it and have the most bug-free version of the program possible. The idea of having multiple computers, it's a standard Windows PE disk, which is the pre-installation environment, which will work on any PC. So you shouldn't need to have more than one of these devices. And in actual fact, if you don't make one of them, and later on you decide, oh, I need to do a recovery, you can actually go and install ESUS to do backup, the free version, on any computer, burn a new DVD or flash drive at that point in time, and then bring it over to your computer, and it'll work no problem at all. So strictly speaking, you don't even have to make it up in advance. I like to have one around just because if I do get myself into a disaster recovery position, the last thing I want to be thinking about is, oh, I got to go to some other computer and make a recovery flash drive. So I do create one, throw it on the shelf. They don't have to be huge. 16 gig will work perfectly fine, and I've got a few of those lying around that are useless for anything else because I have much larger ones. So, yes, I recommend you update. No, you just need one.
Okay. So, anybody have any final questions, comments, or...
Yeah, we do have one that is in the chat window from Eldon. And he asks if any members have a personal choice when it comes to a source for a used laptop, preferably Lenovo because he likes that keyboard. And he's looked at Trailing Edge and PC Room so far. He's looking for one with 6 to 8 gigs of RAM, a 500 gig solid-state drive, and 1 terabyte or more of hard disk drive. Webcam, decent processor, of which I cannot tell the difference between. I'll start just by saying that if you're looking for something with a 500 gig solid-state drive and a terabyte spinning hard drive, 6 to 8 gigs of RAM, that's not going to be all that old a computer, I don't think. So I don't know what the used market will actually have out there with that sort of spec. But other than that, I don't actually have any opinion, so I'll throw it open to the group. If anybody has any ideas about where to buy good used laptop computers in town. Anybody want to pipe in? I guess other than Trailing Edge or PC Room. Oh, Eldon just clarified. He said SSD or a regular 1 terabyte hard disk drive. So that you'll definitely turn up more computers if you're not insisting on that it have an SSD on it.
Some of the online stores that aren't in Ottawa will offer refurbished products that you can find by searching. Even Amazon.
Do you have any personal experience with any of the ones in town?
I'm living in Shawinigan, so I have no idea what's in Ottawa anymore.
Okay.
But I've bought stuff from Newegg and Mike's Computer Store. They're often BC will have some good online outlets that you can find variable deals on. You've got to be very careful shopping online.
Yeah.
But it's often the best place to find used things.
Okay, thanks, Stuart.
One place that you can use in Ottawa is Kijiji. And the good thing about that is you can generally go see the thing before you actually buy it.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I've actually bought memory that way, but I've never bought a whole machine, so.
Okay, it doesn't sound like we have anybody else with opinions. So do we have any other questions?
Yeah,
thank you.
I just got another invitation for updating the feature update in Windows. Now, I had a pretty bad experience doing it on my desktop. This one came in for my laptop, and I was just wondering if they cleaned it up since my first experience, the update on 2004.
I think that other than it definitely is getting ongoing fixes and things like that, but by and large, it's the same thing you're getting now as was first offered, with the exception of if your computer was blocked because of typically driver problems where some piece of hardware was using a driver that was incompatible with the update, and they have now come out with a fix for that so that your hardware is compatible with, as far as Microsoft is concerned, with 2004. Other than that, it's pretty much the same thing. I haven't heard a lot of problems. There's been some issues that I've heard of, people in a little bit oddball situations where problems have cropped up, but it's not to say it hasn't. I would actually like to hear, is there anybody on the call tonight that has updated and had a problem? I've updated two machines so far, and they both went very smoothly. Is there anybody out there other than Bernard, who had problems going to 2004.
I did. I was able to go to 2004 fine, but then I got another, there was another update to 2004, and this one did not want to go, did not succeed. And I got a message it was not possible to install, and it reverted back automatically to the previous version. So it's still 2004, but it is a smaller update, I guess.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
And I'm not too sure what to do about that one. If I should just, I try a second time and I got the same result. So it takes quite a while to install and backtrack. So I'm not too sure what to do, what I'm going to do next.
Yeah, if it is trying to install, if it keeps trying to install automatically, you can actually block it. I wrote an article going back a number of years ago on how you could block updates. Once you get it once, you get the KB article number, and you can use this utility that'll say, you know, don't even try to put this on my computer. And that will stop it from trying to install all the time and then reverting and so forth. And then what I would do is just keep looking at every monthly update to see whether everything seems to be happy. I had some problems with some oddball things that I was able to block, and then about 4 months later, a monthly update magically fixed the problem for me. But you have to be a sort of continuously checking every month, because they may fix that particular update at any time for your computer. But as I say, if it is trying to install it constantly on your computer and then failing and reverting, you can block it. If you can't find the article, let me know and I'll dig it out. And I could get it posted maybe to the Q&A section on the website as well as to how you can do that blocking.
Okay, thank you.
And I would strongly suggest that before you do the feature update, you make a full disk image of the system.
Yeah.
If the feature update goes south, all you have to do is just restore the image. I haven't received this update on my Windows box yet, but there is a new version of Linux Mint out. And so they sent me these messages saying, you know, you should update. So I thought, well, what the hell, I'll update Mint. And so I let it run. I told it to go ahead. It took forever. And eventually it didn't work out very well. But all I had to do was go back to my disk image and restore the Linux partition, just the Linux partition, which took 2 minutes, and then I'm back in business. And my solution was to not update, but actually to do a fresh install, and that worked fine.
Yeah. Yeah, anytime you're doing a major update to Windows, a feature update in particular, I also agree. I highly recommend that you do an image of your machine just prior to doing the update, and that way you can recover quite easily.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we're 20 minutes over, more or less, Chris, so it's probably yep. We can wrap up.
Okay, sounds good. So thanks very much, everybody, for attending. I hope you found it useful, and we will see you next week. Don't forget, send in anything that you've got for suggestions, questions, ideas, something you want to share, send it into suggestion box at opcug.ca. If it's a question, we might be able to research in advance and find the answer before Q&A. Otherwise, by all means, show up at Q&A and you can ask your questions there. So thanks very much, and we will see you next week.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
Thanks, Chris and Alan.
Thanks, Chris and Alan.
Thank you. Thanks, Chris and Alan, and everybody else who participated. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
For the close.
Good night, Archie.